Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Today, we're getting to know Mitch Cosentino, a vintner and winemaker at Puyuk Group, and a consulting winemaker at J. McLeland and Lost Chapter. Mitch has been in the business for 30-some odd years, and he's a local legend in Napa Valley. Truthfully, he probably forgot more than most of us will ever know. His stories are compelling. In fact, their lessons in hard work, humility, and unrelenting stamina through thick and thin. He's known for his breadth and depth of experience and crafting a diverse portfolio of award-winning wines as he continues his legacy of being his own man and doing the right thing, no matter what. Hello, I'm Ilona Thompson of Palate Exposure. I'm here with Mitch Cosentino, a Napa Valley legend with storied career, and I can't wait to get into how it all began. Tell us, Mitch, how did you wind up in the wine world? Give us a bit of a background that preceded that.
Well, let's see. My grandfather made homemade wine with my dad and uncles in Gustine.
Yes, see.
Gustine, California. South of Modesto, where we were all, well, where my dad and his siblings and myself were all born. And I remember tasting it when I was a little kid, a really little kid, and it was mostly vinegar. Because by that time, my grandfather had he was up there in age, and he really didn't pay attention to replacing barrels and so on. And
old school.
Yeah, but unfortunately, nobody had the guts to tell him that it was. In fact, I don't know if any of the family even really knew. You know, but when I was a kid, I went, "Tastes like salad dressing, Dad." And anyway, but. The irony of that is that, you know, I ended up involved in that. A living. But that was the beginning, and then the later jump in what was being done. I think the, it was just kind of the bits and pieces. When I grew up, you know, there was wine in the family. Mm-hmm. We had, even as kids, we had wine as, you know, like on Thanksgiving. And so, unfortunately, the most memorable was probably drinking cold duck, which isn't a great memory. But when you're a kid, in cold duck, sweet red sparkling wine.
Right on again, huh?
Yeah. So that was, not necessarily something that was, that got me started. Mm-hmm. But I grew up in a business family. I mean, my dad was in the clothing business, had his own stores. Then he sold, got out of it for a couple of years, probably when I was in junior college, I think. In junior high. And then, got back into the business working for someone else. It was a small chain called Kaufman's Menswear, very high level clothing stores. Because in those days, people are surprised, but in those days, there were a lot of clothing stores for men and women and everything else. There wasn't the Costco's and the Targets and all of that. So it's a big deal. Nowadays, they're rare.
Since. Yes, I don't think we dress up anymore.
Yeah. So, and my dad had a couple of stores in Modesto when he sold, and then he, when he went back to work for Kaufman's, it was in Modesto, and we had moved to Modesto in the late 50s. And I was going to school. I started working, actually started delivering Fuller Brush.
Huh.
Once I had a car, which I had a car at 16, thanks to my my grandmother, my mother's mother, and I got their car when they got a new one. So I was able to do delivery, and because of, I guess, my background and some of my ability to communicate with people, the guy who I ran routes for actually said, would you like a small route that you can call? And this was for Fuller Brush. You talk to people today about Fuller Brush, nobody knows what it is. You know, I have to tell people, have you heard of Avon? And they say, yeah. Well, Fuller Brush was kind of before Avon, but it was house things for the housewives.
Mm-hmm.
Because people were home. It's a different world. And so I came around and I used to knock on the door, give them their little gift that could be a comb or a something. Maybe a sample of some sort of cleaning element. And anyway, that's kind of how it started. And I went there, and that's how I worked my way through high school. And then my senior year in high school, I went to help out at Kaufman's Menswear. My dad said they needed some help down here to do some holiday Christmas business and work through when we're shut down from school anyway for 7 weeks just before Christmas and mm-hmm. through the New Year's. And I went down there, and they wanted me back. They wanted me to come in and help them there and transition into opening up what was a new division, which was the fashion wear, which was basically bell bottoms and body shirts, introducing that to the world.
I hope you have pictures.
There are, I did some modeling those days, so there are pictures of me there that my sister seems to have.
Oh, good.
Yeah. But anyway, that kind of evolved, and then it was an easy decision for school because Modesto had one of the finest junior colleges in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a little broadcast program, too, and that's what I was going to do. So I went to work for them,
mm-hmm.
Basically... after school evenings and weekends, Saturday, Sunday, Thursday, we were open till 9, and I worked my way through junior college, and they gave me an option to work at one of their stores at three different places, actually more than that, but three different cities that all had broadcast programs, Sacramento, Reno, and Chico.
Hmm.
And Sacramento was the closest to home, it was the biggest school. It appealed to me the most.
Uh-huh.
And went to work for them and worked there for an additional 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And when I graduated, I got out. I was really burned out by that time.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I basically took a year off.
You had a career.
I mean, I was going to take a year off. Let me put it that way. Then, a good friend of mine who's the assistant golf pro the head pro at Antigua Golf Club said, I need some help. Can you help me out for a little bit? Because he lost his assistant. Fine, I'll help you out. So I worked for him for like 9 months as an assistant. And I said, I need some time to get away. So he was able to find somebody else. He wanted to turn the club over to me. I have a golfing background also, so I'm kind of the golfer of the wine industry, which puts me into a lot of different other situations too. So, and even back at that time, it was something, but finally I got away. And then what happened was, while looking for a broadcasting position and really unable to find something, especially in Northern California, which is a desired market, it was the height of equal opportunity. I always tell people you had to be a female minority to get a broadcasting job because people paid attention to that. it was one of those more visible type of situations, and I understood that. So I looked for other things because I had sales background, I had business identity to me, and so for the time being, temporary, I was looking for rep jobs and stuff like that. And I had taken an interest in wine in college, never studied it. And that interest basically, you know, got me into tasting wines. And I started to learn wines by starting with Cabernet, which is probably backwards from what most people learn or start about learning about wine. But I had a friend of mine who ran a wine and liquor store in Modesto that was a very wine conscious person, and I really learned a lot from him. And then he split off and had started his own stores a couple years later, of which I then was doing tastings with him weekly. He always appreciated what I had to say and comments and all that. And he, and then an opportunity came up with a friend of mine said, hey, this beer and wine distributorship has an opening for a wine sales guy. Well, that's one way of dipping my toe into the wine business. And I went and I had already interviewed for a wine rep job without any experience in wine, other than I knew I had a growing knowledge of wine, self-study. And I lost out in the finals to a woman.
Oh, so,
no, again, not an issue, not really a, you know, a choice thing, because she was very good and she remained in the business for many, many years. And frankly, she probably deserved the job more than I did with my background. But I ended up going to the work, which was a great break for me because the distributor was Valley Vendors, and Valley Vendors was owned by Gallup in Modesto. The homeland for Gallo.
How convenient.
So that was great that it didn't happen, because then I ended up getting this job with the competition, who was another, a small Modesto regional distributorship, and we carried all of the most competitive brands for them, against them. And I started as the number eight salesman and a staff of eight, with two managers, and a year and a half later, I was managing the company as a solo manager.
And how did that happen?
I learned from my maternal grandfather when we were kids. He always told us, if you're going to do anything in life, and you're gonna make the effort and energy, spend the energy to do it, make sure you don't take shortcuts, but you do it at the best that can be done.
Good old-fashioned values.
Right. I knew more about wine, I was learning more about wine, I would taste, we would get involved with different wineries from up here in Napa, because we were one of Robert Mondavi's first distributors, that company.
How cool is that?
We represented Behringer when they were known for Trauben Gold.
Trauben Gold.
Nobody knew they made anything else. It was an old winery that was past its day, supposedly.
Should be on the Master Sommelier.
Yeah. So, then we had other things. So, I would taste with these guys. We would bring our staffs up. And it was the other winemakers and winery owners that really took to me. And they're the ones that encouraged me to do more things. And I learned a lot from them. I applied myself more than the others. I turned the worst market as a number eight salesman. I got all the worst areas. I mean, it was everything that was, I mean, they would move better markets off to other people, and you really had to fight for your life. But I made money the first month, which kind of blew everybody's mind, because you have to make sales so much to get to a point where, I mean, you're getting a paycheck, but to get into the commissioned up above the program, whatever it was.
What was it that drove you to be such...
very competitive.
Very competitive.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I played, like I said, five sports in high school and college.
Right.
You know, at different points in time, I was In fact, originally I thought I would get into the sports-related businesses.
That makes sense. So
what happened was that kind of just kind of went on, and it was at the encouragement of some of the more famous winemakers at that time, which was Myron Nightingale and Ed Spraja, were two of the most prominent because they're the ones that brought Behringer out of the dark ages and into the pinnacle of winemaking in a very short area of time. You know, I mean, they were much higher esteem then than they've been in the last 15 years.
That's fascinating. People know Ed Spraja because he was a long-term winemaker record for Behringer.
Right.
Martin Nightingale, however, is not a name that's very well known. I know him by the bottling designate. There was a bottling that was dedicated by Behringer. Tell us about it.
Okay, well, first of all, Myron was part of the famous Myron. Part of the famous class of 41, the University of Cal class of 41, which, if you don't know, look it up. But it included Louis Martini, and there were like four or five of them, pretty prominent people that became the least known. Still became a pretty well known guy for a small area and all that. So that. And his wife was the one, Alice, that actually created the dessert wine, the Nightingale, which, I mean, because she was, her studies in botrytis, in the development of botrytis and creating, growing botrytis, they really did that project.
So would you consider these people foundational in
absolutely.
To Napa Valley?
Winemaking in general, yeah.
Okay.
And then, you know, through these people, I met the Mirasus. And the Mirasus in the late 70s, early 80s, they were the number one premium winery for business.
That's
in California and probably most of the West Coast.
That's extraordinary. And Kent now has his own luxury brand, by the way.
Yeah, well, I helped his father when his father separated from Mirasus.
Really?
In fact, he was with Yvonne Tomas, and Yvonne was a rep for wineries before, and I knew Yvonne, and of course I knew Steve Mirasus. Steve lives here in Napa now.
Wow.
You know, and in fact, I made their first two wines for them.
Yeah.
That was after I'd started in winemaking. Even though I'm still in distribution.
They were in Livermore?
Yes.
All along?
Yes.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So that kind of evolved. That was a whole other thing, another leg of something that I kind of helped a lot of people get started that nobody knows about. So
I'm going to find out. Right,
if I can remember. but anyway, that kind of thing, a lot of those people, and John Parducci. Who was... To me, probably he and Edmund Rossi, which was the overall wine director for Italian Swiss Colony, no relation to Charlie Rossi of Carlo Rossi fame. In fact, exactly
opposite.
Born to
Delaney.
Yeah, Edmund Rossi was a winemaker based out of Asti, really, where Italian Swiss Colony was started. And they were Asti. There was no Asti without them. And that facility, even today, is very big. And I think Gallo owns it now. It was owned by, it got sold and changed. I think Behringer had it for a while. And anyway. I basically had some God-given skills in terms of related to, or senses that actually helped. I mean, very strong sense of smell, with good memory of those things and taste and all that. So that's what got these other winemakers interested in me, and they're the ones that told me, you should be making wine, you should be in this production part of the business. We like you doing what you're doing, but you might want, this is what you can do.
Was it a shock to you that they...
And they said, would you like to have your own winery? make wine. I go, no. I said, it makes me nervous representing wineries, worrying about the vagaries of vintage to vintage challenges on the wines I represent. When I said that, it was a year later that I was actually into making wine and doing it with another winery, small family deal that we got grapes from and wines from up in Lake County, and they had a facility in Lodi. So they dragged the grapes from, well, they were a Lake County family. They bought what is now Lodi Vintners down in Lodi and started Turner Family Wines. And they had some really good grapes, and they used to sell a lot of the grapes to Geyser Peak. That's another little inside story that people don't know. Geyser Peak would sell their grapes to other wineries, their Sonoma grapes, because, and then make wine out of the Lake County grapes because it was less expensive to get the grape. They made money off the grapes.
And the regulatory piece of it wasn't quite as...
No, it was, well, appellations weren't as
okay.
important.
Okay. It's amazing to me, this kind of flow from Lake County, which is now, of course, a hot topic all
yeah.
of a sudden. But, you know, it's not all of a sudden, really. They
no,
have
it
powerful
really
precedents that people just don't realize
well,
took place back then.
Yeah, my first Cabernet was from the Turner Vineyards.
Huh.
And it got me a lot of attention. It was 1980.
1980
yeah.
was your first Cabernet.
Yeah. Cabernet and Merlot, actually released Merlot first. Because I thought Merlot had great potential, and I thought it made wonderful wines, and it really did, but it was very small production, except for right bank Bordeaux, which people didn't know was Merlot. So, those wines, and I will tell you this, because I understood balance even then, those wines are still today fantastic. I just recently had the Merlot. I've had both the Merlot and the Cabernet recently from the first vintage.
You still have it in your cellar?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very famous. I mean, I just broke open the seal on case number one.
How exciting.
Yeah,
wow.
And they remained sealed all this time.
So New World wines have been knocked around a bit because they don't have the history of longevity just physically. However, you're here to prove otherwise, is what I'm hearing. Is that well-made wines back in the 80s?
Oh,
the
yeah. Well, in the 70s, you know.
70s.
I mean, I know I wasn't making them. I collected 1979s. Everybody else was collecting 78s and 80s. 78s and 80s were both ripe vintages, and they were forward, and they were effusive, and they were full, and they were, you know, 77 drought caused maybe got more attention toward a little bit the riper styles. And in this country, that was kind of the beginning of the growth of what Cabernet, or what wines, not just Cabernet, but wines became. In fact, Cabernet was way ahead of Chardonnay. You couldn't sell Chardonnay in the late 70s and maybe even into the early 80s. I mean, it was a non-entity.
How fast?
White wines were French Colombard and Chenin Blanc.
Huh.
And then the biggest selling wine, premium white wine in that era was Mirasu Monterey Riesling.
Was it sweet?
No, but it had some fruit to it, but it wasn't sweet. It wasn't the sweet Riesling. It was probably close to one, but in those days that was not sweet,
mm-hmm.
It was refreshing and really good acidity. And it was made from Franken Riesling, not Johannes. Or Savannah.
Savannah, okay, that makes sense. Was 79 in any way akin to 2011? I realize it's a very rough comparison, but 2011 is the coolest vintage of Lake
no.
Valley.
Yeah,
about?
No, it was a far superior vintage, I think, to what, see, people like to compare it to 98.
Okay.
And actually, for me, 11 was better than 98. 98 was the worst vintage I ever won.
Huh. Curious.
But 79 was a little higher acid, a little bit more closed-in wines, but beautifully structured.
Okay.
And to this day, I still have 79s in my cellar that we've done with friends, horizontal, because I had two other friends that collected 79s, unknown at that time.
Sure.
I found later. I think 79 Heights Martha's Vineyard is second only to their 74.
Wow, those are powerful words. So somehow back then you had the insight of what a great age-worthy wine would be. And at the time, people were probably chasing, like you described, other styles.
Yeah, everybody was just learning about the wine business, or wines. And I took a different approach, because it's part of the finer things of life. I remember saying that. I got to learn that, because it's part of the finer things of life. And I need to learn that.
So it was lifestyle back then. It's
Well, it was awesome. Maybe the direction that to move into through the world, you got to look to the future and where what you need to know, that's kind of the way I probably a pretty adult look at what to do, because none of my friends were doing that. Yeah.
You had a very unique vision in a sense.
Yeah. I guess. But, sometimes, when people ask me how I got in the wine business,
yes.
This is the latest I've ever said in any interview, but how I got in the wine business, divine misguidance. That's usually the first thing I tell people. And that's how kind of it evolved. But in 1979, Chardonnay was just barely on anybody's radar. Sterling was probably the producer. Robert Madavi was saying too, but Sterling was probably the most prestigious producer of Chardonnay. But, and I'm talking about the market era of 79. The vintage of 79 became where you started to see that vintage when it was released, mostly in 81, was the outcoming or the coming out of Chardonnay, and ironically Sterling had a mistake in their cellar and ruined their 79. Somebody pumped red wine into the tank prior to when they were going to be bottling it, and they lost most or all of the 79. And we represented Sterling at the time in addition to these others. And all of a sudden Chardonnay's coming out, and the most prestigious, and probably the most expensive, because in those days, I think it was sold for like $12 or $13. It's coming out, and of course, 79 vintage was the beginning of Farniente, too, really. And those wines were made in a warehouse, I think, in Petaluma, before they had the winery going there. So, there's a lot of history that people don't know and don't even account for.
It's important.
And so that element came out, and so they lost out as being the most dynamic input in the vintage coming out because they didn't have it. So, but history is an interesting thing. It's amazing how few people today don't respect history enough.
I hope you tune in to our next podcast, where we continue our conversation with Mitch Cosentino.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.